You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
G'day and welcome to this week's episode of Red Center, episode number 14, and we have a cracking show for you this week. How are you, Jason?
I'm well, thanks, Mike. How are you?
So this week we're going to be looking at a whole lot of things, a bunch of interesting news to do with what's happening both inside Red and with people using the SDK outside Red. And we'll also be profiling this week, something that I'd like to do a bit more of, actually, is the boxes that are adopting Red as workflow. And we're going to start out with the first box ever to adopt the R3D workflow, which was Scratch by Assimilate. And we'll have a discussion about that. And we're actually not going to do a Red Center this week for complicated reasons to do with international trafficking and surfboards. But Jason, to the news desk.
Right. Okay. Well, one of the main pieces of news this episode is that it's a year ago, Mike, since I saw pictures of you stamping, branding a Pelican case with the Red logo on it. It's been a year since the very first Red Day where everyone, cameras up till about 25 were handed to their owners.
I don't know, I look young in that photo. Yes, it was a year ago that I'd certainly turned up on behalf of our crowd to Red in the warehouse and sat patiently through the entire day until they finally gave us our cameras at the end of the day. And I can only presume that while I love the guys at Red to death, I actually just don't think they're ready to give us the cameras. I think they're literally like still doing stuff to them. And somebody said, go downstairs and give them a lecture and just stall. And so we're all sitting down there going, can I have my camera, please?
we're still screwing them together.
Yeah, I really need my camera. And like, until finally we got our cameras near the very end of the day. And I mean, literally the very end of the day. And so we all quickly put them together to make sure they worked and made sure we had all the right nuts and bolts. And that was a negotiation of itself. Grabbed a branding iron and then took our newly minted Reds off to, in my case, to my hotel, which was just near Red, where I assembled it in the bathroom and tried to film something when I had no viewfinder, no LCD, no EVF. And so I just aimed it at the mirror and guessed the focus, got it wrong. And I wouldn't know that, of course, until I ejected the CF card and checked about a few minutes later. And then working out that I'd managed to get it together and it actually worked, I put it in the bag and we started shooting with it the next morning.
Just because you knew you wanted to shoot something with it. Does it work? Is there something inside?
We were going to LA the next morning, and we met up with a whole lot of visual effects artists, and we got the camera, went into a location, this chick who's a skateboarder, and we just decided to film her with some green and blue screen and see what would happen. And I didn't want everybody turning up, and these are like all, you know, proper seasoned VFX professionals and VFX supervisors all turning up and me going, you know what, I never got the lead that plugs it in. So, but, you know, I'm still amazed to this day. One of the great things about the Red camera is that footage we keep retransferring. Because when we get new versions of Red Alert or Red Cine or whatever, somebody's done a better version of converting R3D files. We just go back to the original R3Ds and run them through. And so that footage has been looking progressively better over the last year.
Oh, dear. No, it looked like it was a great day. I particularly loved the idea. It was very, very much, I loved the idea of people stamping the logo into the Pelican
with
case
the
with a blowtorch.
I'll tell you a funny story about that. They assumed that I somehow knew how to do this because I came from the outback, right? So everyone was like, oh, I get Mike to do it.
Oh, yeah, we do that all the time. Yeah, I've done it to my dog. You've done it to your dog. Like, yeah, we've done it to our kangaroos.
Yeah, exactly. Like all of my kangaroos have been. So I started branding this thing and because, you know, when they said, do you want to put a brand on the box, I was thinking they meant like a sticker, right? And I was like, yeah, sure. And out comes this acetylene torch. And I'm like, what are you doing?
All right.
Let's go branded. So, but what a great bunch of guys. And I got to tell you, that it was one of the most fun days. Because it really, you know, had this pioneering spirit about it. Like, we were there day one. Off we go. No idea what we're doing.
Still don't.
We still produce good pictures, though. I you know, to this day, I really like those pictures.
Build whatever it was.
Yes, and then I discovered myself on Engadget the next day. Somebody violating copyright and stealing my photo off the blog. Let's go back to the more up-to-date news and give us a rundown of where Red is at this week, being the week of the beginning of September, 1 year later.
Well, it is it's exactly as it was last episode. Still getting up to about just under 3,000 under 3,000, getting the cameras out the door. Still the same in terms of back orders and all the gear. So news is as per last ep, I'm afraid.
And so since then, we've spoken. Quantel's actually come out and another one to join the crowd in terms of the adopting the support of the R3D SDK. And Quantel's actually given us a date, haven't they, as to when they believe that they'll be giving us software that'll actually see a Red importer.
I think it's next month, October 08.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm not really familiar with this EQ, IQ, and Pablo. Do you are you aware
sure.
of what these pieces of gear?
So a good way to think of it is, okay, so when they went back in the day, we had Harry, and then we had Henry, and then we had Flame, and then Quantel did a leverage management buyout, and they came out with their own new versions of sort of successors, which were the EQ, IQ, they're like different ranges, and then the Pablo, which is a color grading box. So Pablo does stereoscopic stuff and is quite interesting for that reason alone, as well as normal stuff. And the other two are much more like a standard kind of a Quantel workstation and very popular in the broadcast environment.
Yeah, it seems to be more geared to broadcasts and TV studio type stuff.
But what's interesting is that they've given us that date, and I think what'll happen actually is that IBC is the 11th of September until the 16th, right? So that's 2 weeks from now.
Mm.
So I think we'll see a huge spate of people announcing that they're going to be doing R3D stuff at IBC. The question, I think, if you're being cynical, you'd actually walk around with a memory stick with a couple of R3D files in it. And when someone goes, yeah, we've sold all that, you go, put that in, I want to see you do it. And I want to see you adjust the, you know, this or that and see how they go. Now, I'm not saying Quantel won't do it, I'm sure that they will, but for all of the people that will be claiming stuff at IBC, there's the signing of the SDK document, and then there's the actual implementation of the decoding, the R3Ds. And so I look forward to seeing them. Quantel is probably further advanced than most, it seems, wouldn't you say, Jason, in terms of publishing screenshots and stuff?
Yeah, well, they've definitely looked like they've got a lot of it happening. They've certainly had some stuff in the works, although I think the SDKs, although it was announced, I don't think it's actually been in the hands of developers that long.
Yeah, I think also there are a couple of companies that are, how can I put this? So this is unsubstantiated rumor, not fact, but there are a few companies that have been mentioned as having the SDK where they haven't actually signed the SDK document just quite
okay.
yet. Not stopping their engineers from sort of starting to play with it, but sure. it's a quite an interesting document, that SDK document.
So there's obviously two parts to it. There's the software, which you can get without actually having to sign stuff then?
I think it's more like that you are buying into a bunch of agreements, and legal agreements between large companies always require lots of lawyers toing and froing. I don't think it's anything more than that. I don't think it's anyone playing silly buggers. I think it's just, you know, the politics of it. And I assume most of that will get sorted out before IBC. But we'll hear a lot more in that week, you know, around the 11th to the 17th of this month.
Well, I'm sure whoever starts bringing stuff out, it's all going to be to Red's benefit.
But the one that caught us on the hop, I think, is the sort of weird announcement from Jim, which I just cracked up when I read your Twitter remark about it, which was, for the love of God, get out what you've announced already before announcing anything else. So do you want to discuss this rather cryptic remark made over in Red Crack? I'm sorry, Red User.
Let me find out what he said. Okay. Obviously, we're developing Monstro and Epic and another camera aimed squarely at the DSLR.
DSLR
market.
So that would be digital
single lens reflex.
That would be to say Canon, Nikon department.
Exactly.
Now, do you reckon that is just using like a Scarlett in stills mode, or do you think it is actually a stills camera?
I think, well, to be fighting DSLR market, I mean, already the D90, I'm sick of hearing about the D90, but essentially that's a huge, much, much larger chip than a Scarlett. It would have to be a bigger, to combat DSLR stuff, it's going to have a much bigger chip.
I just don't get why Jim would do it. I mean, like, I understand that he can do anything bloody well feels like it, and I applaud him for it, but why kind of, if you were going to make another camera aimed at the DSLR, like, wouldn't that be like a huge thing? You'd announce it like an NAB or an IBC?
Yeah.
It seemed like an odd thing to just slip into a paragraph.
They love to do that. I'm sure he just delights in slipping out little things and then just letting the seagulls just go nuts all over the one chip.
Well, I'm going to stick my neck out and say that it's actually not a dedicated stills camera. It's actually just a version of the Scarlett aimed at kind of stills options. In other words, you can do stills with it, and you know, it's able to work in that kind of mode, but it's not actually a full stills camera. Having said that, that wouldn't qualify as a DSLR because a SLR camera has interchangeable lenses, has a whole lot of things that Scarlett doesn't have. So is it...
Halfway between a Scarlett and a Red One, I guess. Interchangeable Nikon mount, the Nikon DX format size chip.
I don't know. It seems extraordinary to imagine them doing that. But let's go on to something that's less extraordinary.
Well, I'd rather have that and shoot something that can do movies, it can do stills and do movies that way versus these other like D90s, which are clearly a stills camera that, oh, by the way, we can do video with badly.
Yeah, I mean...
It's a bit of an Irish screwdriver.
But let's go on to the sort of slightly more concrete part of his discussion, which was stuff to do with the actual sensors themselves. So the Mysterium itself is obviously the camera's current chip, and there's two other ones that we so far know about, which is Mysterium X and Monstro.
Monstro.
So how are they going to work with the Epic and with the Red One moving forward, do you know?
No.
So from what I understand
All we know about Monstro is that it has a name.
So as I understand it, what's going to happen is the Epic is going to ship with the Mysterium X. In other words, a chip that is based on the current technology, but a plussed version, as it were. And that will also be a chip that's available for the Red One as an upgrade. And then there's the Monstro, which is going to be, you know, what I think the Epic is actually built for. And that's going to be a free upgrade into Epic users. But whether or not that becomes an option back to Red One, I've read that it will.
It will be. It'll be a cost plus option.
But I think it's going to be a cost option that starts to become, why bother? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think the thing that people keep on missing, we've said this, I think I've said it before, is that the data rate from that chip is locked at about 36 megabytes a second on the current Red One. Even on Scarlett, that's going up to 100, and that's three times the data rate. And it's, you know, you're going to want that. It's going to be... a lopsided, it's like having a top-of-the-line new Macintosh computer and it only has a 30-megabyte hard drive. You're just going to go, it's not a good balance.
But maybe the chip size will be larger. Maybe get a larger, a bit more towards 35mm film size, which obviously Red isn't quite there in terms of chip size.
I guess for me personally, like, I really am excited by shooting high frame rates. I mean, I love the idea of shooting 120 because, like, let's face it, when you shoot a bunch of stuff, you think you want 300 until you actually see what 120 is, and then you go, because, you know, at some point it actually kind of gets boring. You know, it's like the shot lasts for 28 seconds.
Absolutely.
So
you overcrank something too much and you can't cut it in.
Yeah.
You can't get the scissors in and out because it just takes too long for someone to come into frame or get out of frame. As you say, things always look a little bit slower when you play them back. There's a lot of times. I've even shot stuff 36 frames a second, which I wish I'd shot at 30. You know, it just actually even, if you want to just take the edge off something, as they say, it can happen pretty quick.
I mean, there are specialist applications, especially in the visual effects world. Like if you're doing a magnesium explosion, magnesium bursts incredibly fast. And so that's a case where you'd like to go up to high frame rates, like at the 500.
Mm.
You've shot, presumably you have, with a Mitchell, one of the old-fashioned films, one at 500?
In my old days as a camera assistant, used to have the old Panavision. I think it was 300 frames per second.
I think the top one we ever shot with was
516mm.
Yeah, and that sucker just ripped, didn't it?
It's just scary. No wonder digital is taking over. When you had to sort of, you know, lubricate the whole, go around, you know, putting a little eyedropper of oil on it, about 20 different points of the camera just for every take. You know, basically it was 1,000 footer for every, you know, couple of takes, and just like... just scary stuff.
Well, I guess the other problem was that you really wanted the director to say go pretty quickly because when you heard that, you know, speed, you wanted to know that, you know, you were there.
Yeah, you had to get pretty good at preempting the speed word just to let them...
But at 500 frames a second, 2 or 3 second shot turns into a minute. Now, a minute's a long time to not cut in a film. In a commercial, it's longer than the commercial, right?
Yeah, it's a long time to sit through a bad take or, you know, a milk pour that slops out of the bowl or...
So I get that there's an application for 500. I guess there's an application for 300 and stuff. I actually do think, though, that 120 is like a really sensible number, like some number like 80, 100. Even if we're doing miniatures, you know, and I'm talking like proper ILM-level miniatures... or rather, now it would be Kerner Optical. Miniature stuff. You're talking 80 frames a second. Is it like not a dumb number to be shooting at for quarter res or Obviously, these things vary, but, you know, it's certainly in the zone. It's not like 120 years not there enough yet. I think it's actually a particularly sensible number.
So that's the math roughly for a quarter-scale miniature, 80 frames-ish?
It's a more complicated formula than that, but, yeah, basically it breaks down that you tend to want to shoot water and fire, no different than about a quarter-scale resolution, and then you take the inverse square of that times the frame rate that you want to be running at, and you end up with a number like around 60, 80 frames. It's a typical kind of frame rate that you want to be shooting at. And for that, for like proper full-on miniatures where, you know, shooting high speed makes sense because you're scaling stuff. So 120, it's totally a workable number. So I'd like to see 120 at 4K. Other than that, I'm not really hungry for... I wouldn't pay a lot of extra money to go much higher than that. That's not where it's at for me. Now, I think it'd be very cool to occasionally have the burst mode that the Scarlett's going to have, but nevertheless, I wouldn't be wanting to spend a fortune on it. So I think dynamic range is going to be where it's at, not sensor size, not frame rate.
Yeah.
And dynamic range is going to be everything, I think.
Look, I guess once Epic comes out, everyone sees what it's capable of. They can see what they're going to get. Apart from frame rates, they can see the dynamic range, and theoretically, all will work out we'll know by then what the sensor size is going to be.
And speaking of sensor size, our friend Stu Mashewitz from The Orphanage published a particularly interesting guide to sensor sizes on his blog.
Yes, it's fantastic. Thanks, Stu. I've referred to it numerous times this week when I've been looking at things and or looking at what my next little happy snappy stills camera is going to be, and in prepping for this and in thinking, dreaming Scarlet dreams. You go to proloss.com, that's Stu's blog, and it's a great little comparison between sensor sizes, little 2/3 inch Scarlets and the Panasonic LX2 and all the way up to VistaVision. So it's really interesting to see these things laid up, and you realize why there's such an amazing difference in depth of field.
Well, I think one of the really big things that screams to me at this is just how much bigger a piece of image targeting area it is when the film runs through the camera horizontally in a film camera versus vertically.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew that, of course, but a vertical run is what we get in a motion picture camera. Horizontal run is what I get in my old Canon before I moved to digital. And of course, vast differences there. As you were referring to earlier about going for the digital SLR market, boy, does this indicate it, because, you know, it is inherently a landscape format, image. And, of course, when you're running the film down vertically like you're on a camera, you really don't use... You know, you have a lot of wasted film, basically.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, obviously, you're getting a lot more frames per inch, I guess, per foot, I say. But, I mean, that's why when you look at a lot of those depth of field adapters, which I have ordered one, I can totally see why that looks so incredibly different to... like a regular 35mm camera. They almost look like 70mm when you look at the size of what a ground glass for a full, you know, full frame 35mm stills camera is compared to a full frame 35mm motion picture. It's incredibly different. It's almost like twice.
Made me feel pretty good about my 5D digital SLR though.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, like I guess well, we wait and see, but I guess that whole discussion about the digital SLR thing just doesn't fly with the logic of what we're seeing here, because as this clearly indicates, you'd want to effectively double the size of the Mysterium chip just to get to a Canon 5D level, and let's face it, that's a very well understood market.
Yeah, when you look at the size of a full frame Canon like yours, Mike, versus the Red, even the Red, you know, even 4.5K on a red chip, it's quite a difference. The red, even the red one's got a long way to go to catch up with. So, I think.
Well, of course, it's not really competing with digital SLR. It's competing with vertical pull down film. Speaking of which, actually, I was going to ask you this: have you done 3-perf 35?
No,
because it always struck me as like the really logical thing would be to go from 4-perf, which has all this wasted negative, to 3-perf, And the only answer I could ever find why somebody didn't do it was that nobody had cameras that did it. And I could never, for the love of God, work out why not.
Plenty of cameras to do it. Plenty of cameras to do it. You can walk in tomorrow and hire a kit for a feature with three perfs. Yeah, there's plenty of cameras that'll do it. It's more of a feature thing where the gain is more evident, you know, over a long, you know, hundreds of thousands of feet of film.
Yeah, well, it's an environmental issue as well, like the chemicals and stuff. I'd love to shoot less film if I was shooting film, and no penalty in terms of quality, theoretically. Yeah.
No, theoretically, a slight. I mean, I guess for me, I've always been, let's give me as much neg as possible, as big as, hugest amount of...
Well, but it's not going to change the size of the neg, right? It's just going to get rid of the wasted space between the frames on 4 perf versus 3 perf.
Yeah, I guess so.
Especially when you start cropping into... you know, 185, and because that's the other thing, like a nice big chunky piece of 35 mil isn't what we end up with. It's, we throw away the top and the bottom enormously on you know, it's a 4:3 aspect ratio, that full gate 35.
Yeah, I guess so. That's, I mean, I suppose that's the big difference between like super 35 and anamorphic, full frame anamorphic, I guess. That's why it looks so much more interesting. This is sort of using, cropping stuff off versus using the whole frame.
So I'm a bit disappointed that Stu's diagram left off my new Super 8 camera. I was very disappointed in that, Stu. I really like my Super 8 camera. I don't see why it should be excluded. I feel a certain snobbery coming on here from the master of the indie film.
Some may say it's outdated.
What? It's outrage. It's film. It'll never die. Moving right along, one of the discussions that came up on Red User a while ago was somebody discovered a peculiar thing to do with blacks and filters and stuff, and were very quick to sort of publish photos showing that these blacks went to purple, if I recall correctly. And this led to a heated round of discussion, as everybody generally agreed that, yes, that's what they actually did, and wasn't that a clever optical trick that you could make it look wrong? And I believe that's now been solved, Jace, thanks to Tiffin and their new hot mirror.
Yeah, it's basically an ND filters and or a straight filter that has a separate dichroic coating over the top to reject even more infrared. Now, I would have thought that the infrared, the low pass filter, the piece of filter in front, the piece of glass in front of the red sensor,
yep,
is designed to reject infrared.
Correct.
Right, and if you take that filter off, it starts to look incredibly strange and probably fantastic.
The take off the infrared sensor from your red camera, that would be a violation of your warranty, which, by the way, my camera just fell out of. But yes, no, I'm not
that's
about
true.
To.
It's out of warranty, right?
It is.
Excellent. Let's get stuck into it. So yeah, that's a bit of the theory I can't quite get my head around, is how this is helping. Theoretically, it's obviously there must be still that little bit more of the infrared spectrum getting through.
Well, of course, it's a balance, isn't it? Because the thing about infrared to, you know, like the wavelength of light is a continuous spectrum. And so while we can be all high and mighty about, well, this is actually where visible light starts and stops and stuff, really that line is kind of a non-precise, or it's a continuum. And so, you know, you're cutting it somewhat, you know, to split hairs. So I guess what's happening is that to not damage the sensitivity of the camera unnecessarily, they've erred slightly on letting a bit more of the red stuff through, and this probably cuts it back a bit more. But I think the problem was accentuated with ND filters before, because NDs are cutting down the amount of light.
Exactly.
And so you're kind of winding up the problem every ND you dropped in, where these NDs are truer in that respect.
And exactly. You're cutting down the exposure on the visible spectrum, but all the more light is obviously getting through infrared.
Yeah.
So these are, I guess, are blocking off a much more broader part of the spectrum. The idea is, if you're ordering NDs, if you're ordering sets of filters or 85s, etc., go ahead and get the infrared versions if you're shooting on Reds and Genesis,
well,
and stuff like that.
Except I would say that I don't think it's life and death if you don't. Do you know what I mean? Like, if somebody had a set of NDs, like I have, I'm in no hurry to rush out and buy infrared NDs, because, quite frankly, it's a pretty obscure case where it would come up, and it's really not hurting. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have money to burn. I think if you were an indie filmmaker and you didn't have anything but normal NDs, you would feel quite comfortable happily working away. I mean, the Knowing feature film, for example, just used normal NDs. The, you know, the guys that did Jumper used normal NDs. I mean, it's just I think it's a good thing to know about, but you'd be pretty hard pushed to to get a DP, I think, that would complain if you... camera kit was tested on the day before the shoot and discovered you only had normal NDs.
Yeah, look, there's a link to a lot of tests on Red User, which we'll put into the show notes. And yeah, it's that you can see differences, but it looks like there's also, alongside those tests, there's a whole bunch of color graded versions of them, and it just looks like, you know, within the odd tweak, both in infrared ND and non-infrared ND shots can be sort of graded to back to normal. It's not awful, but if you're a fussy person or a picky person with lots of cash,
yeah, because that would be
knock
me.
Yourself
that
out.
Would be me, the guy with lots of cash to waste. Not sure. Really. Yeah. All right. Well, so I guess they're there, and that's good to know that they're there, and it's nice to know that if you haven't bought anything, you could consider these as an option. As I said, I would not be running out and throwing out your current NDs to get these.
No, God, no. I've done plenty of shoots where we've used them. I get them to use them all the time. The whole reason for using, you know, Red and having a nice big sensor is having fantastic depth of field. So I get, you know, I'm constantly asking and looking over at the iris and making sure that we're working as wide open as we can and making sure, get another ND on there. Come on, look, hey, your T4, you got another stop to go. Hello, open it up, get another piece of glass out. So, I mean, Tiffin make them, Schneider make them, Roscoe, they're all making these filters, so clearly there's a market for them. So go and look at the tests and just decide for yourself, I guess.
Well, now, that's sort of it for this week's news. What we're going to do now is we're going to quickly discuss new gear that's out and about, and then Jason and I are going to have a discussion about the first of, hopefully, a series of discussions about actual post-production gear for processing your Red with Scratch, and that's coming up right after our gear discussion. But, Jace, what new gear is out and about available for us pimping our Red?
Okay. Action Products, who I spoke to a couple of episodes ago, who make the fantastic Red version of the Steadicam, have this thing called the Swap Pack. There's a few people making something similar to this. I think this is the first one or two that are actually out there that you can actually order. The idea behind it being that you don't, if you're wanting, obviously, if you run out of batteries or about to run out of batteries, or if you need to change your battery, you do not have to shut down and then restart and do the whole initializing thing, which, as a director, gives me the right shit, basically.
Well, okay. It doesn't happen very often.
Sorry, it does happen. It always seems to happen at the wrong time. I don't even like reloading film, so I hate reloading batteries when it's a two-minute battery reload. You know, I'm just so used to just unplug the thing, plug it into another battery. It should be that easy.
It bothered me earlier when I didn't get an image up very early in the piece,
yes,
but now
true.
I get an image up pretty much straight away. So even though I can't actually use the camera yet, at least I've got something going to the video split.
Yeah.
And that does seem to make a psychologically enormous difference than just sitting looking at a blank screen.
This is true. Or if you need extra battery, longevity, you can use one of these. Basically, it's a double-sided battery mount. You can put one battery on one side and one battery on the other, or keep one battery on one side, and then when you need to swap over, just put that second battery on one side and then take the flat one away.
Can I put a second battery on this and then use that for powering other things other than the camera? Like, can I have one battery feeding the camera and one off to the, you know, automated follow focus and stuff?
Yeah, well, I think what it's got is that sort of odd sort of two-pin sort of system that is more of a, like a Betacam kind of a plug. I'm really not sure what that plug is, but no, I don't think there's any extra LiMos or any other sockets out of it, apart from that sort of standard two-pin power plug that a lot of people use for like their little onboard lights and things like that. So no, the main advantage, as I say, is not having to shut down, and or if you want to have a longer run between battery changes, you can put two on at one time. Looks very nice, very nicely made. It gives you another option also for getting the camera, the battery away from where it is on that double mount, and maybe put it somewhere else on rails, upside down at the back or further along the top of the camera, put it somewhere else.
I'd say my least favorite Red accessory is the battery drive holder. This doesn't feel reddish.
Yeah, no, it's not quite right. But no. But this is another option, and there's another one.
So if anyone wants to give me one of these from Action Products, feel free, and I will use it on all my shoots. And what was the other thing you had for us?
That's it.
Aren't there some 15mm adapters?
Yeah, that's part of this. That's basically if you've got 19mm rods or 15mm rods, you can run this, use these little adapters, which I'm not quite sure about.
But so they basically sit in the...
Just, Yep, sit in the holes there.
Kind of act to like wedges, I guess.
Adapt between 15 and 9 volt rods. So that's $840. And go to actionproducts.ch if you want to order them, or at least have a look at some of the shots. Like a lot of their stuff, it's really, really nicely made. So actually, well, the other thing it does, it kind of rotates to 180 degrees. So you can put a battery on one side and then you can kind of unlock it and swing it around. So basically the battery always, even though you've always got one battery on, if you swap it over, you can always rotate it around. So the battery's in the same spot as it was before you swapped it over, if that makes sense. But yeah, like a lot of the stuff, it looks really well made. So worth a look.
Well, now we want to turn our attention to Assimilate Scratch. And we want to have a look at some of these boxes that you can use for doing professional post-production. And I say professional post-production because they're not obviously free things that you get like you do with Red Cine and Red Alert. And not that there's anything wrong with Red Cine and Red Alert, but there are a whole lot of things those products don't do. And I guess to a certain extent, Jason, I don't think they ever really intended them to do that much. The you know, Red Cine and Red Alert seem to have been pushed beyond what I think Red initially had planned for them in terms of...
Yeah, well, obviously there's a lot of people doing almost like their final colour grade out of it. I know I've done that. It's, you know, it's certainly been used well beyond its intentions because it works so well.
Well, now, Scratch is basically a product that would look familiar to many Red Cine users because, quite frankly, the Red Cine and Scratch share a lot of similarities. Scratch actually comes in two varieties. There's Scratch and Scratch Cine. Scrinny is a sort of cut-down version of Scratch. And I guess I need to just preface this by saying that this is, you know, my personal review, as it were, of the product rather than anything official from them. But I think Scratch is a darn good product, but it has a couple of brilliant features and a couple of limitations. Hopefully they'll see them removed at IBC. Let's start with what it does really well. And it obviously, for a long time now, has been able to open R3D files and bring those into an environment where we are operating directly on the R3Ds. We're not operating on the proxies. We don't even look at the QuickTime proxies. We actually look at the R3Ds and then can bring them into an environment just in the same way that we do with Red Cine, but with the addition of VTR control, timecode control, EDL support, and EDL or ALE export. And this is a big difference over Red Cine, because the thing that Red Cine doesn't do is let you, for example, play stuff in real time, adjust and edit, and export an EDL of the timeline. It doesn't import an EDL directly either to allow you to conform, and this is kind of a pain. But to understand Scratch, you have to actually understand that it existed pre-Red. And pre-Red, it was a data Swiss Army knife, a device that was designed primarily for doing things like conforming and DPX feature film assembly, grading, and data management. So a good example, which is one of the places that I first saw it, Digital Domain had a couple of Scratches, and every morning the visual effects advisor would come in, they'd have polled all the machines overnight to see what rendered, all the new clips would come in, they'd run a script which would automatically load those up into the timeline. The visual effects supervisor would then review last night's renders. If anything was NG, they'd take it out, and then they'd transfer that whole timeline to the actual theaterette, where the director would then sit with the visual effects supervisor, and they would then turn over shots and review them. And if somebody said, you know what, Jace, I think that that shot yesterday, you might have liked that one better. Let's go back to yesterday's version. Then obviously, dynamically, you could just pop back to the previous version because it was just very good at managing those versions. And because all the color grading is done in real time, if, Jason, you were sitting beside me and saying, Mike, can I see that but a bit desaturated? Somebody could just tweak it on the fly, no rendering, we could just see it done. And so it's from that non-videotape background that Scratch approached the market. Now, Scratch 4 has just been released, and it includes some really cool features for Red, not least of which is, Jason, that now, you know, we've spoken this before, the LUTs and the lookup tables of Scratch. Well, yeah. There's actually now a way to say, well, here I've got a lookup table on this footage. I would like you to turn that into a graph for me, and then I'll be able to just manually adjust the graph as I would a gamma curve. And that's pretty cool because most people, I'm guessing now most people find LUTs a little intimidating because they seem like black magic. Number goes in, number comes out. It's nice to see that actually turn into a graph, and you can actually see what's going on with a LUT and understand it a bit better.
Right, because a lot of the LUTs, you'll basically achieve them by, you know, just essentially editing data and tweaking sliders.
And so all of a sudden you've got like, okay, well, here's the LUT we're talking about, and now I can actually put up a little graph that'll show what it is, and that's a two-button operation in Scratch. Some downsides on Scratch, and one of them is just enormous, is that it doesn't handle per-clip audio. And this is a killer for me in terms of dailies workflow, because what you really want to be able to do, of course, is load up all your footage into Scratch and then have it automatically load the audio, which it has lifted from the R3D files or from the QuickTimes. And then, voila, I can just output those to a videotape with an ALE or an EDL of what happened, and then I can ingest that into Avid, and away I go. All my rushes are sunk. Unfortunately, Scratch, for a number of good reasons that I can't go into right now, at the moment doesn't have that clip-based audio, and I think that's a real shame. It's, of course, no worse than a Telecine, because obviously Telecine doesn't have embedded audio when the film comes off, but it is a shame that isn't there, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, if you're taking the time to put this, you know, hook up the sound on the day and record all the sound onto the camera, it's just, you know, double handling. If you're going to have to then go ahead and sync everything, it's a nice little step for editors that don't have to go and sync up footage.
Now, one of the things that Scratch has been very successful in is the stereoscopic market, and that is red or not red. And the reason for that is that early on, the guys implemented a system where you could stereoscopically view two cameras worth of material in real time. So films like Journey to the Center of the Earth, which Jeff Ohm was on the team of, we've spoken to Jeff, and he just sat there and would, you know, grade in stereo, adjust the stereoscopic effect and dynamically with the director sitting there in a theater projected to projectors, and then move forward. So it's got very powerful data handling capabilities. It's got very powerful RED capabilities, obviously vastly better than anybody else. The ability to do stereoscopic finishing, conforms and dailies workflow is really good. Unfortunately, the audio requirements are something that I just, for the love of God, have beaten up a Simulate over to say implement it. And I mean, they know. They obviously are going to do it at some point.
Sure.
It's not that they're pathologically trying to shoot themselves in the foot.
I guess all deaf.
No. The other thing is that, and I think that this is an interesting thing for someone who's a RED user, you get much greater control of color grading with Scratch, though it probably stops short of everything that I want in a color grader. And this, I guess, is the downside of having something that does a lot of jobs, because it isn't essentially a DaVinci Resolve or a Pablo. It's quite inexpensive, relatively speaking, to a Resolve, but it doesn't have the same level of keying control and, for that matter, monitoring that I would like. I'd like to see more monitoring in terms of the, histograms, and I'd like to see parades of RGB and stuff, and it has got some of that stuff, but I have to solve that myself by having a CineTel monitor beside it, and that has built into the monitor a waveform and vectorscope, because I quite like seeing waveforms and vectorscopes, and not all colorists do, but I do. I'm more of a technical guy.
So it doesn't have, I mean, obviously I'm used to staring over the shoulder of someone, say, on a Resolve, where they have the sort of secondary monitor where they've got all your clips and you can do sort of tracking and windowing and all that sort of stuff.
I know, you can do tracking and windowing. And in fact, okay, the new version, which is just about to come out, the previous version had tracking for non-RED clips. The new version that's about to come out, like within days, probably by the time this podcast comes out, has a full implementation of tracking on RED clips. And interestingly, that is an entire new subsystem. They had previously bought... it's no secret, because if you looked at the licensing code of your Scratch, you'd have noticed that it was from Imagineering, and they actually had Moki as their internal... And that didn't track resolution-independent R3D files. And so rather than get Imagineering to fix that, they actually wrote their own new tracker. So that's a tracker for doing roto and for doing shapes, right? Not for...
Yeah, it's such a time saver. I mean, you're talking, you know, fairly simple shapes. You know, if you've got a pack or, you know, tracking a person walking through a shot, you know, you can sort of isolate them pretty easily without having to sort of keyframe it. It's really...
Yeah, totally.
Such a time saver.
Now, I guess for me, I can put up with the having to use like a CineTel monitor or an external vectorscope and waveform. I would like to see the keyers improve, because quite frankly, again, I'm used to really good quality keying from my flame background, and you know that has obviously filtered into luster and stuff. But you know, every product has its strengths and weaknesses. I really think that in a RED workflow for an indie filmmaker or somebody in a data management environment where there's a lot of data flowing through, Scratch is probably the only option right now. And if they can solve the audio problem, it would make it a huge plus for anyone to have for dailies. In fact, I couldn't imagine people just not wanting to get this for dailies workflow.
So you sort of more categorize it as a dailies work system versus day-to-day final grading or DI?
See, if you were, let's say, Jace, you came to me and said, oh, I'm going to do a full-on feature film, major budget, you're probably going to have a pretty sophisticated DI at the end of it. And so you're probably going to end up in a suite beyond what you're going to do in Scratch right now. Having said that, if you were saying, I'm going to make an indie feature, I would say use a Scratch because you'd be able to hold your entire film in there, conform it, work with it, track it. You can even layer up and use, you know, import mats to cut out different shapes and stuff. And you would be able to finish the film. And I've finished films, and one of them we won an AFI award for in Scratch, right? So trust me, it's totally adequate, except for the fact that obviously at some level, if you're in a high-end feature, you're going to want to have every bell and whistle, and that would probably not be the case. So no, I would say that it's a good box as a workhorse. It's like the central hub that you might have at a place that is doing a project, a central hub that can take in the dailies, send stuff out, conform, put stuff together, and just not be that expensive that you care that you've actually left your film in there for weeks and weeks, if not months and months. Because if it's too expensive, you have to dump all that out because you need the suite for another job and you can't afford to run like that. Where this is, you know, the problem I already have with a lot of other workflows is it looks great on paper until I say, well, what are you going to do with this when I need the next job? You know, let's say you do a luster. What am I going to do with this project? When it's in Luster, it's like, well, finish it. It's like, well, I can't afford to book this Luster suite for 3 months, right? Like, it's just not going to happen. It's going to have to go on and off the machine constantly. Whereas I actually could afford to have a Scratch dedicated in an environment for doing stuff. So I think that while I would like a bit more in the color correcting, I wouldn't want to be spending a fortune and then therefore pricing it out of its mainstay. But I must say, one thing that it does nicely and really, really well is keep up with Red in the R3Ds, because the R3Ds, let's face it, they've been changing a lot, and these guys have been very, very good at within a week or so of it coming out for, you know, the general public, like an R3D release 16 type thing. Within a week or so, we're seeing alpha, and about a week after that or two, we're seeing beta and release of that for Scratch, which is...
Yeah, I mean, you just know with a lot of other... As soon as a lot of other places come up to speed and start working with Red, that you just know that there will be delays. The more complicated and more amazing the effort to get something to play R3Ds, you just know the more pain there's going to be when we go to a new build, I'm sure.
Well, this is my thing. I'm a little concerned that some of the other companies will implement an R3D and go, ta-na, done, and then we'll have to wait 6 months till the next release for the next update, at which case Red will have moved through two or three builds.
Yeah, it'll be like Adobe.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, that happened with the digital stills cameras quite a bit. Yeah. Your new digital stills camera came out if you didn't have the new RAW files for it. And I will give peeps to Assimilate, who have worked very hard to keep Scratch very current. If we could just solve the audio problem, I'd have no hesitation in totally giving it 5 stars. But it is a good small company, so they're obviously, you know, the good and the bad. The smaller they're responsive, the bad is they probably don't have regional sort of offices and training all over the world, like you would expect from a bigger company. But
it's a really portable unit, though. I mean, I've seen it on some of the Red Days that you've organised here in Sydney. It's really portable. You could have it on set, or, you know, if need be, you know, it's one of those things you could set it up in a production office, or, you know, this. I couldn't imagine how you could possibly do that with like a big Resolve.
Absolutely, you couldn't. And I think something I personally like about it is it does export good LUTs, so you can actually export LUTs from it. We've actually exported LUTs. Red LUTs that we've then taken into our CineTel on set so that we've been able to punch up looks on set for, say, Ben Allen as the DOP, and those LUTs were actually generated inside. I've got to say, not many boxes handle LUTs well in terms of being able to let you see what you're doing, edit them, work with them, export them in multiple formats. I think that it's good. So
it's really exciting sort of times, I think. I mean, I think it's, you know, opening up a lot of... It may be changing for the worse in some departments, but I think it's really, really an interesting time to be.
Well, because Assimilate's had a head start on this, we have to really set Scratch as the baseline upon which we will judge those that are to follow, because you know, that's what we've kind of got right now. It's out. It's been out for a while. It obviously has been used by a lot of people. We know where the bugs are. And then when other products sort of roll out, post-announcement to actually having it in the field, we're going to have to really, you know, want to judge it relative, I think, to Scratch.
Yeah, red compatibility, I think, is going to be judged against it, I think. You know, you can't beat just, here's my red drive straight off the back of the camera, plug it straight in the machine, there we are. There's the clips up and grading.
Well, that's it for me for this week. Jason, is there anything else you wanted to add?
That's it for me.
It's a happy first birthday for me, though, as I said, sad in the sense that I'm now out of warranty, so I have to be more well-behaved with plugging the wrong lead into the wrong hole of my red. Though, actually, I must admit, I'll let a cat out of the bag here and say that my red is actually back at Red head office, because I thought just before it gets out of warranty, we might just whip it in for a quick once-over. But... yes, hopefully my red one will turn into an epic one in the next 12 months. So by the time we come for our second birthday, I'll be celebrating a completely different... but who knows, eh?
Oh, there's a lot of water under the bridge between now and then.
Okay, so it's probably got one more show we're going to get in before IBC, and then we'll have the IBC show, which we anticipate having quite a lot of red news out of. If you've got anything that you hear about... either before or in the lead-up to IBC, please email us at red@fxguide.com.
Yep, and if you want to contact us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/MikeSeymour or Wingrove.
And next week on the show, hopefully we'll be looking at anamorphic lenses on the Red. We have a project that's happening, we hope, by then, which will be putting anamorphic lenses, which we've managed to... we're not doing it. It's a production that's invited us on set.
Excellent.
And they've managed to source anamorphic lenses for their Red, and that'll be great because I haven't myself shot with the anamorphics yet, so I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome. That sounds good.
Until next time, thank you so much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it. And, Jace, I will see you in a week or so.
See you then. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.